Chapter 33. A pigeon's wing somewhere high up in the great overshadowing trees. And suddenly one of the men before her without moving a limb would begin another speech rendered more mysterious still by the total absence of action or play of feature. Only the watchfulness of the eyes which showed that the speaker was not communing with himself made it clear that this was not a spoken meditation, but a flow of argument directed to linger to now, and then uttered a few words either with a grave or a smiling expression. They were always followed by murmurs which seemed mostly to her to convey assent, and then a reflective silence would reign again, and the immobility of the crowd would appear more perfect than before. When Lingard whispered to her that it was now his turn to make a speech, Mrs. Travers expected him to get up and assert himself by some commanding gesture. But he did not. He remained seated, only his voice had a vibrating quality, though he obviously tried to restrain it, and it traveled masterfully far into the silence. He spoke for a long time, while the sun climbing the unstained sky shifted the diminished shadows of the trees, pouring on the heads of men its heat through the thick and motionless foliage. Whenever murmurs arose he would stop, and glancing fearlessly at the assembly, wait till they subsided. Once or twice, they rose to a loud hum, and Mrs. Travers could hear on the other side of her Georgianson muttering something in his mustache. Beyond the rows of heads, Damon under the tree had folded his arms on his breast. The edge of the white cloth concealed his forehead, and at his feet the two Illinois chiefs, half naked and bedecked with charms and ornaments of bright feathers, of shells, with necklaces of teeth, claws, and shining beads, remained cross-legged with their swords across their knees like two bronze idols. Even the plumes of their headdresses stirred not. Suda. It is finished. A movement passed along all the heads, the seated bodies swayed to and fro. Lingard had ceased speaking. He remained seated for a moment looking his audience all over, and when he stood up together with Mrs. Travers and Georgianson the whole assembly rose from the ground together, and lost its ordered formation. Some of Bellerup's retainers, young broad-faced fellows, wearing a sort of uniform of check patterned sarongs, black silk jackets and crimson skull caps set at a rakish angle, swaggered through the broken groups, and ranged themselves in two rows before the motionless Damon and his Illinois chiefs in martial array. The members of the council who had left their bench approached the white people with gentle smiles and deferential movements of the hands. Their bearing was faintly propitiatory. Only the man in the big turban remained fanatically aloof, keeping his eyes fixed on the ground. "I have done it," murmured Lingard to Mrs. Travers. "Is it very difficult?" she asked. "Oh," he said, conscious in his heart that he had strained to the fullest extent the prestige of his good name, and that habit of deference to his slightest wish established by the glamour of his wealth, and the fear of his personality in this great talk which after all had done nothing except put off the decisive hour. He offered Mrs. Travers his arm ready to lead her away, but at the last moment did not move. With an authoritative gesture Damon had parted the ranks of Bellerup's young followers with the red skull caps, and was seen advancing toward the whites striking into an astonished silence all the scattered groups in the courtyard. But the broken ranks had closed behind him. The Illinois chiefs, for all their truculent aspect, were much too prudent to attempt to move. They had not needed for that the faint warning murmur from Damon. He advanced alone. The plain hilt of a sword protruded from the open edges of his cloak. The parted edges disclosed also the butts of two flintlock pistols. The Quran in a velvet case hung on his breast by a red cord of silk. He was pious, magnificent, and warlike, with calm movements and a straight glance from under the hem of the simple piece of linen covering his head. He carried himself rigidly, and his bearing had a sort of solemn modesty. Lingard said hurriedly to Mrs. Travers that the man had met white people before and that, should he attempt to shake hands with her, she ought to offer her own covered with the end of her scarf. "I?" she asked. "Propriety? S. It will be better, said Lingard, and the next moment Mrs. Travers felt her enveloped hand pressed gently by slender dark fingers and felt extremely oriental herself when, with her face muffled to the eyes, she encountered the lustrous black stare of the sea robber's leader. It was only for an instant, because Damon turned away at once, to shake hands with Lingard. In the straight ample folds of his robes he looked very slender facing the robust white man. Great is your power, he said, in a pleasant voice. The white men are going to be delivered to you. Yes, they pass into my keeping, said Lingard, returning the other's bright smile, but otherwise looking grim enough with the frown which had settled on his forehead at Damon's approach. He glanced over his shoulder at a group of spearmen escorting the two captives who had come down the steps from the hut. At the sight of Damon barring as it were Lingard's way, they had stopped at some distance, and had closed round the two white men. Damon also glanced dispassionately that way. They were my guests, he murmured. Please God I shall come soon, to ask you for them. As a friend, he added after a slight pause. And please God you will not go away empty-handed, said Lingard, smoothing his brow. After all you and I were not meant to meet only to quarrel. Would you have preferred to see them pass into Tenga's keeping? Tenga is fat and full of wiles, said Damon, disdainfully, a mere shopkeeper smitten by a desire to be a chief. He is nothing. But you and I are men that have real power. Yet there is a truth that you and I can confess to each other. Men's hearts grow quickly discontented. Listen. The leaders of men are carried forward in the hands of their followers, and common men's minds are unsteady, their desires changeable, and their thoughts not to be trusted. You are a great chief, they say. Do not forget that I am a chief too, and a leader of armed men. I have heard of you too, said Lingard in a composed voice. Damon had cast his eyes down. Suddenly he opened them very wide with an effect that startled Mrs. Travers. S. But do you see? Mrs. Travers, her hand resting lightly on Lingard's arm, had the sensation of acting in a gorgeously got-up play on the brilliantly lighted stage of an exotic opera whose accompaniment was not music, but the varied strains of the all-pervading silence. S. I see, Lingard replied with a surprisingly confidential intonation. Be but power to, is in the hands of a great leader. Mrs. Travers watched the faint movements of Damon's nostrils, as though the man were suffering from some powerful emotion, while under her fingers Lingard's forearm in its white sleeve was as steady as a limb of marble. Without looking at him, she seemed to feel that with one movement he could crush that nervous figure in which lived the breath of the great desert haunted by his nomad, camel-riding ancestors. Or is in the hand of God, he said, all animation dying out of his face, and paused to wait for Lingard's hurry through, then continued with a fine smile, but he apportions it according to his will for his own purposes, even to those that are not of the faith. Such being the will of God, you should harbor no bitterness against them in your heart. The low exclamation, against those, and a slight dismissing gesture of a meager dark hand out of the folds of the cloak, were almost understandable to Mrs. Travers in the perfection of their melancholy contempt, and gave Lingard a further insight into the character of the ally secured to him by the diplomacy of Bellerub. He was only half reassured by this assumption of superior detachment. He trusted to the man's self-interest more. For Damon no doubt looked to the reconquered kingdom for the reward of dignity and ease. His father and grandfather, the men, of whom Jorgensen had written as having been hanged for an example 12 years before, had been friends of sultans, advisors of rulers, wealthy financiers of the great raiding expeditions of the past. It was hatred that had turned Damon into a self-made outcast. Till Bellerup's diplomacy had drawn him out from some obscure and uneasy retreat. In a few words Lingard assured Damon of the complete safety of his followers, as long as they themselves made no attempt to get possession of the stranded yacht. Lingard understood very well that the capture of Travers and Delcasser was the result of a sudden fear, a move directed by Damon to secure his own safety. The sight of the stranded yacht shook his confidence completely. It was as if the secrets of the place had been betrayed. After all, it was perhaps a great folly to trust any white man, no matter how much he seemed estranged from his own people. Damon felt he might have been the victim of a plot. Lingard's brig appeared to him a formidable engine of war. He did not know what to think, and the motive for getting hold of the two white men was really the wish to secure hostages. Distrusting the fierce impulses of his followers, he had hastened to put them into Bellarup's keeping. But everything in the settlement seemed to him suspicious. Bellarup's absence, Jorgensen's refusal to make over at once the promised supply of arms and ammunition. And now that white man had, by the power of his speech, got them away from Bellarup's people. So much influence filled Damon with wonder and awe. A recluse for many years in the most obscure corner of the archipelago, he felt himself surrounded by intrigues. But the alliance was a great thing too. He did not want to quarrel. He was quite willing for the time being to accept Lingard's assurance that no harm should befall his people encamped on the sandbanks. Attentive and slight, he seemed to let Lingard's deliberate words sink into him. The force of that unarmed big man seemed overwhelming. He bowed his head slowly. "Allah's our refuge," he murmured, accepting the inevitable. He delighted Mrs. Travers not as a living being but like a clever sketch in colors, a vivid rendering of an artist's vision of some soul, delicate and fierce. His bright half-smile was extraordinary, sharp like clear steel, painfully penetrating. Glancing right and left, Mrs. Travers saw the whole courtyard smitten by the desolating fury of sunshine and peopled with shadows, their forms and colors fading in the violence of the light. The very brown tones of roof and wall dazzled the eye. Then Damon stepped aside. He was no longer smiling, and Mrs. Travers advanced with her hand on Lingard's arm through a heat so potent that it seemed to have a taste, a feel, a smell of its own. She moved on, as if floating in it with Lingard's support. "Where are they?" she asked. "They are following us all right," he answered. Lingard was so certain that the prisoners would be delivered to him on the beach that he never glanced back till, after reaching the boat, he and Mrs. Travers turned about. The group of spearmen parted right and left, and Mr. Travers and Delcasser walked forward alone, looking unreal and odd like their own day ghosts. Mr. Travers gave no sign of being aware of his wife's presence. It was certainly a shock to him. But Delcasser advanced smiling, as if the beach were a drawing room. With a very few paddlers, the heavy old European-built boat moved slowly over the water that seemed as pale and blazing as the sky above. Jorgensen had perched himself in the bow. The other four white people sat in the stern sheets, the ex-prisoners side by side in the middle. Lingard spoke suddenly. "I want you both to understand that the trouble is not over yet. Nothing is finished. You are out on my bare word." While Lingard was speaking, Mr. Travers turned his face away, but Delcasser listened courteously. Not another word was spoken for the rest of the way. The two gentlemen went up the ship's side first. Lingard remained to help Mrs. Travers at the foot of the ladder. She pressed his hand strongly, and looking down at his upturned face, "This was a wonderful success," she said. For a time the character of his fascinated gaze did not change. It was as if he had said nothing. Then he whispered, admiringly, "You understand everything." She moved her eyes away, and had to disengage her hand to which he clung for a moment, giddy, like a man falling out of the world. 3. Mrs. Travers, acutely aware of Lingard behind her, remained gazing over the lagoon. After a time he stepped forward, and placed himself beside her close to the rail. She went on staring at the sheet of water turned to deep purple under the sunset sky. "Why have you been avoiding me since we came back from the stockade?" she asked in a deadened voice. There is nothing to tell you till Raja Asim and his sister Amada return with some news, Lingard answered in the same tone. Has my friend succeeded? Will Belarab listen to any arguments? Will he consent to come out of his shell? Is he on his way back? I wish I knew. Not a whisper comes from there. He may have started 2 days ago, and he may be now near the outskirts of the settlement. Or he may have gone into camp halfway down, from some whim or other, or he may be already arrived for all I know. We should not have seen him. The road from the hills does not lead along the beach. He snatched nervously at the long glass, and directed it at the dark stockade. The sun had sunk behind the forests, leaving the contour of the treetops outlined by a thread of gold under a band of delicate green lying across the lower sky. Higher up, a faint crimson glow faded into the darkened blue overhead. The shades of the evening deepened over the lagoon, clung to the sides of the Yemma, and to the forms of the further shore. Lingard laid the glass down. Mr. Delcasser, too, seems to have been avoiding me, said Mrs. Travers. Why, you are on very good terms with him, Captain Lingard. He is a very pleasant man, murmured Lingard, absently. B-Buddy says funny things sometimes. He inquired the other day if there were any playing cards on board, and when I asked him if he liked card playing, just for something to say, he told me with that queer smile of his that he had read a story of some people condemned to death who passed the time before execution playing card games with their guards. And what did you say? I told him that there were probably cards on board somewhere Jorgensen would know. Then I asked him whether he looked on me as a galler. He was quite startled and sorry for what he said. It wasn't very kind of you, Captain Lingard. It slipped out awkwardly, and we made it up with a laugh. Mrs. Travers leaned her elbows on the rail and put her head into her hands. Every attitude of that woman surprised Lingard by its enchanting effect upon himself. He sighed, and the silence lasted for a long while. I wish I had understood every word that was said that morning. That morning, repeated Lingard. What morning do you mean? Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.